Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture. What does it really take to walk away from a top corporate career and build a business in the middle of a global crisis? Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Jinesh Vohra, founder of Sprive and former Goldman Sachs professional who left the world of investment banking to become an entrepreneur. From a family shaped by three generations of business builders to launching just before COVID and navigating the cost of living crisis, Jinesh brings a rare perspective on risk, resilience, and timing. We'll explore what it means to leave security behind, how to survive when the world turns upside down, and what young founders can learn from building through uncertainty. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Jinesh Vohra. Jinesh is the founder and CEO of a company called Sprive, and this is a UK-based mortgage app. And Jinesh is nodding. It's designed to help homeowners become mortgage-free, which sounds like a very good thing, faster. Is that right, Jinesh?
That's completely right.
That's completely right. I'm glad we got that right. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today. Why don't we begin? Why don't you tell me just a little bit about what Vohra does and what your business is and how it helps customers so that everyone listening knows where we're headed.
Yeah, so Sprive essentially, like you said, it's a mortgage app. There's about 11 million homeowners in the UK, and normally it's typically quite expensive to get on the property ladder, so people tend to borrow hundreds of thousands of pounds over a 25 to 40 year period. And the cost of interest is quite alarming, especially with the way the rates are at the moment. And so people download the app, it's completely free to use, and we help people in kind of three core ways to help them kind of pay off their mortgage faster and save interest. The first one is essentially you earn cashback, which you can pay to your mortgage with just one tap by the app. And so imagine you do your grocery shopping, you buy that cup of coffee, that takeaway. Think about anything you do in your life, and every single spend when you do it through the Sprive app, turns into a mortgage overpayment, which means that you start to save interest and pay off your mortgage faster.
Hang on, I want to ask about, how does that work? I mean, so if I buy a coffee, you get cash back that then goes towards your mortgage.
That's correct, yeah.
How does that happen? So, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So even if it's a penny or two, it still counts.
Yeah, so exactly. We work with like over 2,000 brands. So the likes of like Amazon, Tesco, Asda, Sainsbury's, John Lewis and Boots. I mean, the list really goes on. And it varies from brand to brand, but imagine you're grocery shopping, because that's something that people do every week. And a family will typically spend, you know, easily £100 to £200 a week on groceries, and everyone's got to like live to eat. So it's an essential piece of spending. So you go into, say, you know, Tesco's, and you type in, say, £126, if that's what your shop came to. You press pay now in the app, one tap, and you essentially get like a barcode, which instead of paying via your card, you scan the barcode and instantaneously you get money into your Sprive account, and in the app, one tap, and that money goes straight to your mortgage. And the great thing about that is as you start to use the app, you can start to then visually see how much interest you're on track to save, how many years you're on track to knock off. So you might start and you might see in the app, oh, I'm on track to pay off my mortgage 3 months earlier. And the more you use it, 5 months, 6 months, we've got customers using
the
app.
Freedom day comes closer
We've, got customers, like there's a recent customer who posted on social media, and she's on track to save £84,000 in interest and knock 14 years off her mortgage. I mean, there aren't many apps anywhere that can kind of that much of an impact.
She must be quite a big spender to have done that.
No, so we have a second feature as well. So the shopping really kind of adds up, and some of our customers are putting like £25 to £70 just by kind of doing the everyday shopping. But then also we have a spare cash feature. So this is where, I don't know if you're familiar with auto-saving apps, where you can like scroll away spare cash. And so you link your current account, and then we look at your spending, and you can set a limit. So you might say, I can afford anywhere between £1 and £25 a month. You know, others who are more affluent might say, I can afford anywhere between £200 and £400 a month. And then we work within those limits. And so say, for example, like we just went through Christmas. Most people spend a lot of money during this time on presents and Christmas dinner. We might then set aside a lot less money compared to like weeks and months where they're saving and essentially spending less. And then with one tap, again, that money can go towards your mortgage. So the shopping is a great way to get started because everyone spends. With the cost of living crisis, it's obviously very tough for people, but everyone has to shop. And so that just makes a huge impact in being able to just constantly chip away.
Right. And you said there was a third. So we've got those two channels. Yeah, there's a third way you can pay down.
There's a third feature as well, which is helping people refinance. So we scan the market every day for better mortgage deals. And if we can help you find a better mortgage deal, we'll essentially help you get that with combining kind of tech with free advice.
Wow. So this sounds to me like you must have done a huge amount of work to get this set up. I mean, all these relationships with these big companies, Amazon, Boots, all the retailers, and the technology behind it.
Yeah, I mean,
a substantial investment, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, we support 14 of the top lenders in the UK. So we cover 85% of the residential mortgage market. So if you have a mortgage with, say, Barclays, Santander, NatWest, HSBC, all the big lenders we support. And obviously that takes time. And then we work with over 2,000 brands. And again, that takes time. It took me a while when I initially was building the product to convince some of these brands to work with Sprive. So I've been doing this for 6 years. So it does take time and it does take capital investment as well.
Who were harder to convince, the banks or the brands?
I would say the lenders is more challenging because they're bigger organizations. And if you think about it, historically especially, mortgages, lenders make a lot of money from mortgages and paying off,
they don't necessarily want you to pay it off quickly.
Exactly, people paying off their mortgage,
it sometimes makes it a little awkward.
It kind of erodes their income and P&L. And so you've got to
sometimes you get a penalty if you pay it off too soon.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so we help with that as well. And through the app, you can track how much of your allowance you've used. But that was the challenging piece. But lenders understand, and I can go into more detail why lenders work with us, but it's around finding common ground. And once you're able to do that, we're finding now that more and more lenders are now coming to us and asking us how we can kind of join Sprive, which is nice.
So what I like about what you said as well is Sprive is free of charge to the user.
Completely free, yeah. So
what's your business model then? Where do you make an income for yourself? Because every company has to support its cost base.
Yeah, I suppose the easiest way to kind of understand it is if you think about cashback companies like Top Cashback and Quidco, very traditional cashback companies, and then you think about how they make money. So in every shop, we take a cut. So we provide a discount and we get that funded by the merchants.
I see. And so then, some of the cashback goes to you and some of it goes to your
customer.
Exactly.
Most of it will go to the customer, but we'll take a...
What's the split?
Yeah. I'm not going to say that because it varies from brand to brand.
It varies from brand to brand. Yeah, okay. But you are saying most of it goes to the customer.
But most of it does.
So it's more than 50%.
Yeah, more than 50%. Right. And it's like what we build is it's obviously not just the cashback app. We're connecting to people's bank accounts, into the lenders.
So there's a lot of trust involved here.
There's a lot of trust. There's a lot of technology that's involved, and that's obviously very expensive. For every payment we process, and we process, someone's shopping in our app every 3 seconds. So it's the engagement is very, very high, but all of that costs money. We have to do like anti-money laundering checks, and so obviously if we're not sustainable, we want to keep it free. But it's funded by the merchants, and that's consistent with all cashback brands.
It's the shopping that actually makes it viable for you.
And then the second part is things like you think about comparison sites. So you sell they sell car insurance and they sell home insurance and what other energy switching. Yes. We do all of that as well. But the difference is every time you do that, you earn money towards your mortgage. And just on the cashback, I think sometimes I speak to people and they're like, well, cashback towards your mortgage, how can that make a dent? But actually, it's the benefits of compound interest, because most people aren't aware that lenders calculate interest daily. And so if you just take a £100 grocery shop, and say you earn £2.50 on that grocery shop, and that goes towards your mortgage. For the average person, that has a 3x multiplier effect once it goes onto a typical mortgage. And so, you end up saving between £7.50 to £10 on one shop. And imagine you do that 52 times a year, and then
because of the compounding effect.
The compounding, it actually saves you a lot of money. And then obviously there's holidays and car insurance and home insurance all starts to add up. So, most homeowners, I'd say that our cashback rates are probably the most impactful when it comes to people's personal finances. It's just less than the actual money that is, because it's effectively being invested in a manner that's ultimately tax-free, which is obviously good as well.
What if doing good was the smartest business move you'll ever make? I'm James Reid. CEO of Reed. In my new book, Karma Capitalism, I reveal how being a Philco, that's a company where at least 10% of shares are owned by a charitable foundation, has become our business superpower. Companies like Lego, IKEA, and Novo Nordisk share the same Philco identity. These businesses last longer, inspire loyalty, and make a bigger impact on society. This book is part manifesto, part practical guide. Karma Capitalism is available now at karmacapitalism.org. Being a good business is good business. So I've got so many questions for you, but I mean, I'd quite like to just go back to your sort of origin story, because I mean, you're talking, you know, about compound interest. You're obviously a person of great financial literacy, and you know, financial literacy is an interesting issue in our society, because I don't think that many people are well equipped with financial, but you obviously are. And I know why, because you come from an entrepreneurial background, entrepreneurial family, and you worked at Goldman Sachs Bank for 14 years, is that right?
14 years, yeah. Yeah,
can see you. Yeah, so in terms of background, you're sort of ideally prepared for this kind of business venture. So let's start with your family. I think it would be interesting, because you mentioned to me earlier before we started recording that your grandfather was an entrepreneur in East Africa and your father was an entrepreneur. Will you just tell us a little bit about your family story? Because I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, sure. So if you go back to like my grandfather, so to give you some context, he grew up in rural India, in a state called Gujarat, on a farm. And at 12 years old, decided to leave the farm without his dad's blessing. So had a little bit of a disagreement. And he went with his uncle to East Africa on a boat to essentially start working. And he started working in construction as a laborer, very young. But these things, you know, happen, was very common.
As a 12-year-old.
Yeah, as a 12-year-old with his uncle, and then started kind of picking up the trade. And he did that for a long time. But he obviously learned the trade very well, and you know, started to know people that were in that.
Which country was this?
This was in Kenya.
Right.
Essentially, he then in his early 30s decided that he would start his own construction company. And then use some of the people that he knew, and then kind of get projects and do the work himself. And it was great for him, because he's obviously able to kind of build wealth, and that wealth was enough for him to send back to India and give my dad, as an example, a very good education. And so my dad went to boarding school, grew up learning English in India, which at the time was only for, you know, people who were a little bit more affluent. And then my dad decided to come to the UK. Literally with £5 in his pocket, because there was the opportunity to kind of do so. And again, when he first started, he didn't really have a lot of like connections. It was very difficult to get a job. And I remember when I was very
young. Where did he go in the UK? Where did he live?
So in London. Yeah. And what they typically do is they find a house that they someone's living there, and they will just all kind of live there and bunk up until, you know, they can obviously afford their own place. And at the time when I was very young, he had three jobs. So I remember him like at Asda at the checkout doing that. He was then kind of cleaning toilets and being a cleaner. And then he started his own business and he set up his own accountancy firm. And one of the things he did is, because there was a lot of people that was in a similar position to him, but they didn't have the education that he had. So they struggled to do simple things like read letters in English.
Right.
And so he used that community to kind of help them, and also use that network to kind of build his business. And that was good enough for him then to give me and my brother a private school education. And that allowed me to then obviously get a good university degree at the University of Warwick. And that led to me getting an internship at Goldman Sachs, and then me getting offered a position and then kind of progressing there for 14 years.
So the Goldman Sachs experience, I mean, I imagine you learned a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Has that been helpful for what you're doing now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've got no bad word to say about the organization. It's a very tough place to work. They've got a very...
Tough in what way?
In that, like, it's every year they'll cull the kind of the poorest performers. It can go up to like 10 to 20%.
Right.
So that always kind of keeps you on your toes. I really like that.
So like the Premier League, if you're in the bottom. So
that's
a bit testing.
And the hiring process is very rigorous, and you may hear stories, but you know, sometimes you're doing 7 to 10 interviews to be able to get a role. And so the caliber of people that you're working with is really impressive. And I've always been of the mindset that I like being the best. And so that pushes you when everyone around you is very driven. And there's a culture that people are prepared to go above and beyond. It's very common to work 70 hours, 100 hour weeks. And it's not just FaceTime. People are just trying to outperform and outdeliver. And that in itself, that environment has been very good for me. I think the other thing that I think about Goldman's is that they have a very entrepreneurial kind of environment. So they at the early kind of doors, they really try to teach you and coach you to think about the business like it was your own and to try to come up with ideas and innovate within the organization. And they reward people who think outside the box. And it's a very flat structure in that just because you're more junior doesn't mean you can't get responsibility and you can't progress quickly.
And your ideas will be listened to.
And your ideas. But you've got to be able to maneuver through the organization, and that's a challenge in itself. But if you can adjust and you have the self-awareness, it's a very rewarding place.
So you'd recommend a stint at Goldman Sachs to a would-be entrepreneur of the future, would you?
Look, I'd say if you want to be an entrepreneur, then there's no better way than actually being an entrepreneur. But you might find that you might make some more mistakes. I think with the, like I've always, when I was at university, I wanted to start my own business, but I just didn't have the acumen. I didn't have the idea. I just didn't know how to go about it. And so I fell into that career. And I did tell myself at the time, remember when I was at university, I said, I'll do this for 2-3 years, build up some experience and then start my own business. But you then get sucked in. You're chasing the promotions, and then 14 years later, you know, I was still there.
Well, I imagine you were well paid. I mean, it was a good lifestyle.
It gets harder. It gets harder and harder,
as you
progress, because the way it's a very big bonus culture there. So if you're a poor performer, you know it, because your bonus is zero, or it's very much like, why did I spend all these hours and sweat and tears, kind of pushing myself? And it's a kind of a signal you should leave, otherwise we're gonna like push you out of the organization.
So if you get zero bonus, the writing's on the wall.
Yeah, the writing's effectively on the wall. But if you perform well, they pay you well. And so it does become harder and harder. And I think for myself, I'm not so, obviously everyone likes money, but I'm not so driven by money. For me, it was legacy. Like I take a step back, and my grandfather, if he hadn't done what he'd done and made those brave moves, if he'd had listened to his father when he was 12 and not then make the bold step from everyone around him, carried on being laborers, and he started his own, you know, had the bravery to effectively take risk and start his own construction business. And like my dad, if he hadn't done what he did, then my life would have been very different. And so I want to have a legacy too. I don't want to be the dud in the kind of the, when you look at the generation.
I can understand that anxiety. But you're making good progress, to be by the sound.
Exactly.
Of it.
But for me that was the driver. I feel like you only live once, and I wanted to leave a legacy. And my mindset changed when I had children. So I've got two young boys now, and I want to show them that anything's possible. And my dad showed me, and my grandfather showed me through the way they lived and the things they did, that anything's possible. And so I want to do the same for my boys.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you'd be a very inspiring father for them. I mean, so you were at Goldman Sachs, and you've been there for a while. And then I imagine you had this idea. So at some point while you were there, near the end of the 14 years, you decided to sort of branch out on your own. So what triggered that decision? How did that come about? And then you made that courageous step, you know, like your father and grandfather yourself, which, you know, a lot of people might be thinking about and then maybe do, maybe don't, but you did it. So talk me through that a little bit, please.
Yeah, finish. Sure. So, I mean, when I was there and you'd go out after work, it happens quite a lot that you have a few beers and you'd be talking to colleagues about, you know, a business idea or, you know, just the idea of doing something, because through the kind of the role that we did, you would actually meet quite a lot of entrepreneurs. Goldman Sachs, for example, has a private wealth division, and a lot of the clients are entrepreneurs. And so you do see that, you know, people that taken risks have done, you know, some of them have done very well for themselves. So there's always that kind of itch. And then, but in reality, I wasn't ever really seriously looking to do my own thing. What happened was a colleague of mine that I used to work with grabbed me one day and said, "Janesh, you want to go for a beer?" And I said, yeah, sure, let's invite, you know, the team. And he was like, no, just me and you. And I was like, okay, this is a bit strange. And we went to a pub that normally no one, like none of our colleagues ever go to. So it was
so quite he didn't want to be overheard.
He didn't want to be overheard. And he basically said that, look, he's decided to leave Goldman's and he's going to start his own business. And to give you some context, his great-grandfather was the king of Hyderabad. So in the 1940s, he was literally the richest man in the world. And his whole family are entrepreneurs. And so for him, it was always on the cards to essentially start his own business. All his family are entrepreneurs. So when he told me, I was like, okay. And he was like, I had this idea that we should do something together. For some reason, he felt that I'd be a good person to go in business with. And so the first question I asked him was, so what's the idea? Mm. He goes, I don't really have an idea. I just know that we should do something together. And because I always liked the idea of doing something, we literally after work sit in the cafeteria and get our laptops out and brainstorm business ideas. And we started in the summer of 2018. And then we came up with the idea for Sprive in about November. So literally during that process, we had ideas after ideas. And as we start to validate the ideas, very quickly it became apparent that you know, those ideas weren't very good. And and Sprive was essentially idea number 5 or 6. And that's the one where we started to really kind of get excited about. And then, 9 months later, I left.
So you are you doing that together then? Is he an investor or partner?
He's my partner, yeah.
Right. So that's good. So it's interesting. You just decided you were going to do something before you had the idea.
Yeah, so we were going to look into it.
Almost the first decision was we want to branch out and start.
Yeah, so the idea was we liked the idea of it. He was definitely going to leave.
Yeah.
So we then were like, I'm not leaving a good job until I'm very, very sure. And so, 5 months to come up with the idea, but really being really intentional about finding an idea. And then once we came up with the idea for Sprive, conceptually in November, it was only until July the following year that I actually resigned and handed in my notice.
So you're talking July 2019.
Yeah, July 2019. And the time spent was really me actually understanding, will this actually work? Could I actually build it? Having conversations with investors, people in the mortgage industry, understanding what technology I needed to build. Because I needed to believe for myself, because I have a family. And the good thing that I had done, which kind of ties back to why I started Sprive, is I had paid off my mortgage. And I've been very fortunate, but I'd gone through that journey and I did it very aggressively.
At Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, but obviously that salary helped. But we did it very aggressively in 4 years. But that was the only reason why I could go to my wife and say, hey, look, I've got this crazy idea. I want to kind of leave this kind of corporate job and do this. I think if I...
What was her reaction?
I mean, she wasn't happy.
No,
because she was pregnant at the time.
Well, it's a bit unsettling, I imagine. And crazy idea sort of sounds exciting, but maybe...
She's an accountant, very risk averse.
Okay.
And I told her that she would never have to work again because we'd paid off the mortgage. We just started a family. And so I had to kind of sheepishly go to her and say, look, you know that I told you never have to work again. Oh. I need you to go back to work because I really want to do this.
Oh, so she had to go back to work.
So she had to go back to work, yeah.
Well, but that's a good thing about being an accountant, I would stress. You can always get a job.
Yeah, that's very true. But she went part time. That was the compromise. And I said, don't worry. In a year, I'll be earning a salary again. Took me 4 years. So
took you four.
It took me 4 years to earn a salary.
So, but she was obviously patient.
Yeah, she's been fantastic.
And supportive, which is really important.
Yeah,
isn't
really
it?
Important. Yeah.
So I'm just thinking back. 2019. Obviously, what happened next was the pandemic, which must have been very disruptive to your plans. Because
yeah.
You said it took you 4 years before you were able to get a salary, so we thought we'd have to go to 2023. What were the consequences of all that disruption?
Yeah, it wasn't ideal. You kind of take the biggest risk, and then suddenly the kind of pandemic happens, and obviously that was a very prolonged episode in people's lives. And I was very keen to not launch the product and the app during the pandemic. I just felt like it wasn't the right time. We were a slightly different app. When we launched, we didn't have the shopping part of the app. We just had the spare cash feature that I mentioned earlier. And when people are worried about their kind of jobs and their livelihood, the last thing they're going to do is start to overpay on their mortgage. And so we paused. And then we're also thinking about runway, because with the tech company, you've got people that to pay every month, and started looking at the numbers going, okay, how long is this going to last? Because if it lasts much longer, we're going to run out of money. And so I had to like hire a new team. We were using kind of third party agencies initially. Mm. And then we had to find creative ways to like bring that in house and find some interesting ways to like prolong our runway. And then, yeah, so it was definitely an interesting time. It was a curveball that I didn't
Were there any expect. Positives in terms of it giving you time to think about the service? And I mean, you obviously added extra business lines during that time and developed the offer through the app.
Yeah, no, we did that afterwards. So, after COVID, we launched. So I suppose the one thing we did, and so my business partner that I mentioned, he reads a lot of books, and he's very much a product guy. And when you read those books, a lot of them say, when you start a business, build your MVP, your minimum viable product. And so he was like, we need to build this. And he wanted to build like a really basic version of the app. In my head, I had a picture of what the app should be and had a lot more technology, a lot more automation, but he pushed quite hard and I caved in and said, okay, we'll build it. And my suspicions were right in that no one wanted that app. It was too much friction, too much work for the customer.
Well, the MVP, the minimum viable product, wasn't viable.
It wasn't viable, but it took us 9 months to build that, and we spent money on it. The good thing is that I'm quite frugal, so we didn't. You know, I kind of say if you make mistakes, try not to make big mistakes that completely blow you out of the water. But because we made that. But there were positives as well in that we learned about what works and what doesn't work, and we've got to like test some of the functionality.
Well, that's the purpose of those.
But yeah, exactly. But COVID did give us more time to be able to then build and iterate and then build the right version, so that once COVID ended in October 2021, we actually publicly launched.
Right.
And that version, in the first, I'd say, day that we launched, we got an article from This Is Money, and the headline was something like, the UK's first mortgage overpayment app, is it any good? And we literally on the first day had 2,000 people download the app, and so that was like nice.
Yeah.
And so yeah, sometimes these
the power
things
of communication.
Yeah, sometimes these things all happen. It's just it's just so funny how like luck sometimes does play a part for sure.
I would agree with that. Luck's very important.
Yeah.
But so is preparation.
Yes.
So yeah, that's when you get lucky. So you develop this app. It's interesting because often people say, you know, start small, start with a minimum viable product. I mean, I've heard that from other guests. But you recognized it required more development and complexity to deliver the service you wanted to deliver. So you took a bigger risk, in a sense, doing it the way you did. How did you finance that? I mean, because what we're talking about here, building apps is not cheap, I know, because we do it ourselves, and especially complex ones that have friction-free offers. So I'm confident you must have put a lot of money as well as time into this endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fintech. We're registered with the FCA, so there's a high bar there. It's not something you can just bootstrap. Let's put it that way. So we invested our own money. So again, another risk there in terms of taking money from our savings and putting that into the business. And then just people that I knew in my network. So I never asked kind of what I call like a friends and family round was the initial kind of injection that we got. And I never would ask friends or family for money. I would literally talk about what I'm doing and what I'm building and the fact that I'm leaving Goldman's to start this. And I started this while I was at Goldman Sachs. So I tell people, this is what I'm doing on the side. What I found is that people tend to get FOMO. So as an example, we had someone that's quite high profile, like the former CFO of Microsoft US and India, who I kind of knew through my network. And I met him and I was telling him about what we're doing, and he does angel investments. And he was like, I like the idea of this. I might invest. So I started telling everyone that he's probably going to invest. And he had actually 100% committed, but everyone else was like, if he's going to invest, then I want to invest. And I went back to him and I said, look, we pretty much got all the money in. Are you going to come in? And he was like, yeah, sure. And so
he did invest.
So, these types of things kind of helped. And
you didn't ask, but you just shared the information.
Shared the information. And people would come to me asking me, please, can I invest? Because they knew me. They knew I'd either worked with them, or I'd gone to university with them, or they were like members of my family. And they knew that, you know, I've got, you know, they like to think I've got quite a sensible head on my, you know, and so I kind of would have thought this through, and they saw the excitement and they believed in what I was saying, that they could see this kind of being very big. And so, yeah, they gave me money, and that kind of was that kind of initial investment.
And that got you.
That got us to like launch. Yeah. And then once we launched, you know, with things like, you know, the first day, a couple of thousand people downloading the app, I then went to angel investors, so a little bit more professional investors, and then they invested, and that was
so done. You had to put together a sort of presentation deck.
Yeah, presentation, yeah. Financial model, and so I did that.
What advice would you give to people who are seeking angel investments?
I think it's all about the network and getting kind of warm introductions. It's super key. So if you don't have that network, you need to build that network. And because I was at Goldman's, people automatically think that you have this whole huge network of angel investors, but that wasn't the case. I was in the risk division, so I wasn't a trader. I wasn't an investment banker, and so by definition, risk, people in risk are generally are very risk averse, and so you'd hope so. So there wasn't like a lot of people I could tap on, so I had to build that network from scratch. And one of the things I did, for example, was post on LinkedIn every day, and that was really helpful because people
about
what I was doing
every day,
Monday to Friday, and I would literally just share my story. So if I'm doing, you know, something like this, you know, I take a picture and post that, and if I was whatever it was, and so people started to feel like a real connection, and they could almost feel like they were living this journey with
me. So interesting, so helpful to people to know that.
And a lot of people obviously knew me from you know, my corporate days, and a lot of people that are employees who work in corporates, they do have that itch that, you know, and I think a lot of them would do really well. I think we have so many talented people in the UK. It's just having that kind of that bravery and taking that risk, and it is a big risk. But those people would see, and they would know people that know people, and then introductions, they would be willing to help, and then just network, meet people. And that helped a lot. And you tend to find with angels, they like to invest in groups. So if you find someone and they invest, they'll then start to bring their friends over, and that can be a real domino effect.
They tend to be networked themselves.
Yeah, networks, exactly. And that worked really well. And then I did one more round after that, which was in kind of towards the kind of the beginning of last year. And that was more institutional. So that was like VCs, venture capital.
How much did you raise in that?
So that was $2.5 million cash, and then $3 million TV media for equity. So we now, for example, have a TV ad that's running on across Channel 4. So Channel 4 Ventures also invested in Sprive. And the reason why I did that investment was to get more brand awareness.
So hang on. So how did that work? So they give you airtime?
They give you airtime, yeah.
For equity, yeah. You're trading equity for airtime?
That's right, yeah.
Interesting. And have they given you, I hope, a lot of airtime?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. Yeah.
And is it working? Does advertising work in that respect?
Yeah,
Did it work as well as This Is Money?
Let's put it this way. Since I closed that last round, we've been growing 30% month on month. Right. So that's pretty strong. I'm pretty happy with that. So yeah, we've been growing pretty rapidly.
Did you do any other trades for equity? So you did
just the cash, which is obviously the $2.5 million, and then the TV media deal.
Did you put a valuation on that?
Yeah, there is a valuation. Yeah, that we put, and then I'm actually going out to market now and doing another raise. Yeah, so we've grown pretty substantially, and we want to be more aggressive. There's 11 million homeowners in the UK that we can help, and so we want to kind of help as many people as possible. So yeah, we're raising more
capital.
You have
big ambitions for Sprive. Yes. So I understand that you went on Dragon's Den to raise some money.
I did.
Just done this.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like?
It was interesting. So I've watched Dragon's Den like since I was the age of 20.
It's like an institution. We've watched it, but
so to be on that show was very surreal. I remember like watching the show and almost acting like, you know, as if I'm a dragon and being like, that business is great, or that business, you know, how's that ever going to work? And it's a great show because I do think it encourages entrepreneurship.
I agree.
And so when I got the opportunity and I got an email in my inbox saying, would you like to apply? I was like, okay, yeah, why not? I generally, when I think of Dragon's Den, I think of actual products, like things that you can actually like touch and feel. And, you know, from memory, I can't remember seeing many apps on Dragon's Den, but I went through a process. It was quite a rigorous process.
In terms of being selected?
In terms of being selected.
When you say quite rigorous,
what was that? As in, like, it was things like sending a video interview, like a video clip of yourself on camera, doing the pitch. And then there was things like interviews over video calls where they interview you, you know, a few different times. And then there's a whole like diligence process on your business, because the BBC are very careful about making sure everything that's said and everything you're saying is 100% accurate. The last thing they want is to kind of mislead the public.
All the dragons.
All the dragons, yeah, because obviously that's very true, because they want to make sure that what you're saying is completely factual, because ultimately they are going to invest their own capital if they decide to do so.
Yeah, the BBC's facilitating this process. Exactly. They're like the investment banker in a sense.
Yeah,
introducing you to possible investors. Yeah,
yeah, and so obviously it was really nice to then get selected. And then they give you very short notice, or at least for me, they gave me very short notice in terms of going, okay, here's the studio date. You need to do your pitch. And
so the date for the pitch was just suddenly like next week or something? Like
exactly.
So
very little time to prepare. And the actual pitch, you need to make sure you've memorized it. And because I'm in financial services, they're very like, they made sure that they made it clear that I had to say what I prepared. I couldn't go off piece.
Terms and conditions apply.
Because
which I find myself saying on our ads quite a lot.
Because they were
that was very rigorous.
They were very rigorous in terms of what, you know, they wanted to make sure everything that I said was completely factual.
So you managed to stick to the script.
And so if people watch it, I encourage look to be on the iPlayer. So it's the second episode in this year's season to have a look. I don't want to give too many spoilers away. I think it's
you won't be giving any away, because it will have come out by the time.
No, that's very true.
People
yeah.
can hear this.
Yeah,
but did it go well?
Yeah. So
I won't ask for details, but were you happy?
It went well. I was going to say, in terms of preparing for the pitch, I had my two young boys help me prepare, because the way I kind of thought is that it's obviously a very stressful time, like you're in that you got the cameras on you got all the lights, and so I kind of told them, like, while I'm doing the pitch, jump on me, like shout at me, like scream in my ear, and they did that, and they really enjoyed it. But I made them part of that process. But if you can pitch when you've got two young boys like pushing you and screaming in your ear, then you can definitely do it
under the scrutiny.
Like you wouldn't kind of get phased and be able to like deliver. And that was like the key for me in terms of, I was in the studio for 7 hours, so it was a really, really long day. I didn't realize, when you're watching it, you only see it in a small snippet, and then I was actually in the actual den part of the recording for about an hour and a half, and it was like a real investment pitch. The dragons ask you a lot of questions, and they're very clued up. Because I've raised investment, I was very comfortable with the questions they asked. But yeah, it was very rigorous.
So I mean, they're investing their own money, so
they do this, and it's television.
Yeah.
So they will throw curveballs. They will try to.
Were there some surprises? What was the toughest question?
So, I mean, it was a while back, so but there were questions. That one thing I was, I had these red lines that I was trying not to talk about too much. So as an example, if they asked me about my background, I literally just wanted to say I work in financial services, and I was trying to avoid the fact that I work at Goldman Sachs as an example. Because
why?
In the past, I've done some press, and the comment section, you know, people were comparing me to like Rishi Sunak and my work, you know. And so
it's, don't read the comments section. unless it's about someone else.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. But sometimes people can see that as a good thing, because financial services, and they probably want someone who, you know, who's had that background, so that, because they're obviously trusting Sprive with their one of their largest household commitments, but it can also backfire.
So you didn't want that to come out.
Yeah.
So I didn't, but did it come out?
So I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. So I see it at the same time.
So you don't know what they've left in and taken out.
I have no idea. Yeah. So
that's interesting.
So I'll see it when everyone else sees it. Yeah.
But you put 7 hours of your time into what will be a few minutes of television.
Yeah. Exactly. 10, 15 minutes. I remember at the end of the process, I walked out and I was so drained, like mentally, I was so tired because it's very intense.
Quite emotional.
Yeah. Exhausting. And they lock you in like a little room. They don't really like get you to talk to any, you can't really bring anyone in.
Is that called the green room?
Yeah, the green room, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know why they call it. They're never green.
And they get you to put on makeup and things that you'd normally never do. So
exactly.
Yeah, so interesting experience for sure.
So you found it interesting. Is it something you'd recommend to other entrepreneurs?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, there was a couple that I did bump into in the green room for like literally 45 seconds. And they were literally shaking. They were so nervous. There were a couple. I don't know how they got on, but the nerves can really build up. I think if you're not careful, you can kind of get into your head. But luckily, I was able to stay calm, and I actually really enjoyed the experience. It was nice.
Yeah, I think it's quite important to try and enjoy things like that, even if they're sort of new and unfamiliar, because I think the energy you're able to demonstrate comes over.
Exactly. I think hopefully that comes across on camera. Yeah. But I came out of it really enjoying the experience. There's no regrets for sure.
Oh, good luck with that.
No, thank you.
I'll be watching.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're really in sort of fast growth mode with your business. I mean, you're moving from startup to scale up, it seems. Is that a fair description?
That's probably fair, yeah.
And that brings challenges of its own, doesn't it?
It does.
So you have to hire more people.
Yes.
So where are you in that journey now? And what's on your mind, Janesh?
So after the last round, we had the team, but then we needed to look at the team and look at where the gaps were and how we could, take things to the next level. And so we did hire. We hired in all areas of the business. Because of my days at Goldman's, I was very used to hiring. I started managing teams probably when I was about 24. It's quite early in my career, and so I've always known the power of hiring good people. Hiring good people, absolutely, even my corporate career, made me look good and made me be able to kind of outperform. And so that's been super key.
So what do you look for? You're looking for good people. Give me a bit more detail.
Yeah. So I think So I go off gut quite a bit. But we try to, gut feel is quite important to me. But what I initially do is I'll have a process. So I'll interview them. And the first half an hour, I typically, obviously I see their CV. And in my mind, it depends on the role, but I have an idea of the caliber of the kind of person that I'm looking for. So let me take an example, like marketing hire. So I wanted to hire someone to run marketing. And I wanted someone who had consumer, fintech, app experience. So what I did is I made a list of that in the last 3 to 5 years, all the consumer apps in the UK in the personal finance space that essentially had done well and grown really, really aggressively. And then I wanted to find someone who had been through that growth period for at least, and worked there for at least 3 years. And so once you get that universe of like apps, and then you get that kind of criteria, you're really narrowing down the population.
So you were very precise.
So
about
in that example, I was very precise.
And how did you find them from there, though?
I used the recruiter in that example, and then I hired a product person as an example.
So you used an agent.
I used an agency, yeah. And then for a product hire that I did, I did both. So I did agency, and I also did a LinkedIn a job post. And on LinkedIn, it was crazy. The number of applications that I got was massively overwhelming. But there was only one person that actually sent me an individual message, connected with me, sent me an individual message, and then had like this... Only one person did that. But
listening there, people, if you want to get a job, that's quite a good tip.
So he did that, but he also had like media, like in, is it Medium, where you have like loads and loads of like content about product. And so you could tell he was someone who's really passionate. He had an amazing design portfolio, but also he was talking about, you could just see realms and realms of content over the last like 15 years that he'd been putting out in the ether. And so straight away I could see
through his LinkedIn,
through just the Medium kind of, I think it's called Medium. It's like a platform where you can like share your leadership and your thoughts and your work. And you could see he loved product. And so then I was like, okay, I'll interview him. And when I interviewed him, I was just, in my head, I wanted to give him the job on the spot. But what we tend to do is also give people a task, and I try to make it awkward. So I like doing things that most people would not do. So it'd be like I'll give them like a little task to do. I might even tell them to do a second round interview in that task on a weekend. And so if they don't want the job that much, then they're not gonna really be the person for me. And so like, I try to see how they react.
So what sort of task? I mean, I've got the apprentice in my mind.
Yeah, so for like product, I'd essentially say, go look at my app.
Right.
And this is what we do. And if the objective is to get more people to download the app and do their first shop, as an example, because when you download an app, a lot of people browse, but they don't actually start using the product. And what we found through the data is once you start, is something that you really incorporate as part of your life, and then it becomes a regular habit. But the biggest challenge with anything like an app is how many apps do you download and they just sit dormant, right? You want people to like engage. So I said, this is what we currently have. And look, I designed the app, me and my partner, and we're both from Goldman's. We're not product designers. Mm. We've just been making things up as we go along and using kind of, you know, our common sense where possible. What would you do?
Right.
Now, some people, what they'll say when you ask people is that, they get very upset. They're like, you're basically asking me to do free work, and they would just either refuse or they'll do something, but it'd be very like high level, and it just, there won't be a lot of effort put into it. The people that really want the job will put a lot of effort. And when I do the first round interview, I spend half the interview convincing them why accepting a job at Sprive is going to change their life. And so I do a lot of that. And then the second half is where I really start to interview them. And so if that doesn't convince them to then put some real thought and hours into the project and then present, then you just know that they're not going to have the energy. Quite.
That's very interesting. I mean, because that's an interesting mindset issue. Oh, you're just trying to get me to do some work for free versus, what if I put a lot of effort into this, I'll get the job and I'll have made a good start.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I've already made some progress.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is another way of looking at it.
Exactly. And then the final thing that I always do, I then get the team to make sure culturally is a good fit, because...
So the team are part of the process.
The team, yeah. Because for me, it's very important that people get on and that there's this... I've been in an environment like, you know, like a corporate environment like Goldman's, where there's all sorts of people. But when you're small, you want a really nice environment, because if one or two people don't get on, it can become really toxic. And so for me, just people that are easy to work with, that was kind of very important. So I wanted to make sure the entire team had this kind of warm, fuzzy feeling about new individuals kind of joining, and that they felt like they could work with them. That was super important to me as well.
I'm imagining, listening to you though, Janesh, that your business model doesn't require you to have a huge team.
Yes, we have 16.
16. Yeah. And in a way, you know, as you grow the company, the upside of this potentially is that, you know, the income could outpace the costs substantially in the future.
Yeah, already we're like cash flow. In November, we were like cash flow positive. So we're trying to really create a sustainable business. There are a lot of fintech apps out there that spend a lot of money. And I've seen it time and time again with founders who get a lot of like venture money, and they balloon their teams to like 100 headcount when they're making like £1 or 2 million in revenue. And it just doesn't make any kind of business sense. And they're almost trying to grow into that headcount. I don't feel that's the right way to do business. So we do things quite differently. And then you've got AI, and the power of AI is just incredible. And so I'm just amazed around just what it can do. And so
you're embracing.
And so we're really embracing that too, yeah.
So looking forwards, I mean, you talked about legacy. Yeah, how would you like the sort of next chapter to sort of evolve for you and your business? What's your sort of, you know, if you're visualizing the future for Sprive and yourself?
Yeah, so
would you like that to look like?
So I like to be the go-to app for homeowners. I think if you take a step back and you think about a homeowner, there's three core parts of their life. There's obviously their debt, their mortgage in particular. There's their spending, So their everyday shopping, which we, you know, we play a big part. And then there's the saving. And again, we can help people save, and we want to create like saving pots that earn interest, and maybe the interest can help you overpay your mortgage. And so I feel like if we can tackle those core three parts of someone's life, then that just gives us a lot of opportunity to could do good for that individual and help them, you know, essentially become kind of debt-free faster and get some of that life back. And so that's kind of really important. I kind of ask some of our customers, like, what would you do if you're mortgage free? And they, you can literally see their eyes light up. I'd quit my job, or I'd go part time, or I'd do, you know, spend more time with family, or go traveling. And so we want to help more and more people. There's 11 million homeowners in the UK, so you know, we're about 100,000 customers active. So a long way to go in terms of helping more people. And then in terms of beyond that, you know, people have student loans, credit cards,
yeah, well, the car student finance. Loan thing is a big issue.
It's a big issue, yeah. So yeah, in my head, like, we, you know, that's something that I'm kind of keen to like help people on. Globally, there's a billion people with some form of household debt. So there's a lot of people that we can help. So I think the sky's the limit is the way I see it. And I'm very driven. I feel very energized. I don't feel like what I'm doing now is work. I get to do fun things like this, and you know, it's nice. Yeah. It's good.
Well, I can feel your enthusiasm for what you do, and that's infectious. So yeah, well, that, I wish you every success with that. I suppose that I'm thinking that the team you put around you is going to be critical to your future success. What sort of skills are you looking to complement your own?
Yeah, and no, it's a good question. So I think it's I'm a big fan of delegating and trying to make sure you've got clarity of thought. I think if you get drowned in the detail, it's really difficult to kind of steer the ship. And so I learned that through my corporate days. And so delegating is very, very key. I think at the moment, my team is very, very strong. I think as we add like more things in the app, that's when I think we'll probably start to look at like hiring new heads, but I'll be very thoughtful about it. So my head, for example, we help people refinance, and at the moment we do that with a partner. But over time, I'd like to have my own kind of mortgage experts in house, and so I can see us kind of really building out that part of the organization, and kind of be a good business line. Maybe we'll get into like insurance. And again, I don't know much about insurance, and so it might make sense to have someone who's got a lot of experience within the insurance space. Who knows? We might, you know, help in people's pensions, so I think it all depends on how we take the business forward. And then where my skill gap is, and then we'll look for the best people in that space, and you know, I'm pretty persuasive. We'll convince them to.
Well, someone said to me, you know, find good people and let them get on with it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, once you've set the direction in terms of your delegation.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's being very thoughtful. I think there's two ways you can hire. You can either hope and just do like and let them come to you, or you can go and approach the people that you want. And I always feel like if you have more intent in your hiring, the outcome is likely going to be better. I also use my network. So if I do hire someone, I'll ask people like, who do you know in this space that you think would be good? And I try to de-risk it as much as possible. The other thing I tend to do, and I haven't had to do this, but I have done it in my corporate career, is if you know someone very quickly when you hire them, if you've done a bad hire, just try to address the situation pretty quickly, because
by which you mean exit them.
Yeah, because otherwise if you got it wrong, then just do something about it quickly. It's better for both parties, is what I would say. But we've been very lucky. We've not had to do that since I started Sprive.
Hope is not a strategy, I like to say.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to have intent.
You got to have intent. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wish you every success with your business, which it sounds to me could go in any number of exciting directions. And I'll watch it with great interest in the future. And hopefully maybe one day get you back in the studio, Janesh, so you can tell us about your journey through the next chapter.
Yeah, happy
to. Sure will be very interesting. I always ask two questions at the end of my podcast. And they're always the same. The first one, and because at Reed we love Mondays, is what gets you up on a Monday morning?
So the first thing, if I'm honest, is doing the school run. So that has to be done. And then I actually do like a PT training session. So when I was building the business, I didn't really look after myself, and I was eating badly, putting on weight, and it got to a stage where I just turned 40. And you know, I started to kind of see signals that if I don't look after myself, that could not be good for me. So I do that, and that's a really nice way to kind of get my head in the right frame. And then after that, I meet the team and we set the agenda for the week, so that all my whole like leadership team know exactly what I'm expecting, and that allows me to then kind of focus on what I need to do. And I'm kind of comfortable that, you know, the leaders in my organization, they've got clear direction, clear accountability. And then obviously I can touch in different points throughout the week, but it just really allows me to kind of hit the week with a bang. I also have this this routine of like creating a to-do list that for the week, and what's urgent and what's important. And I'm a big fan of just crossing things off. Monday is all about getting myself mentally in the right place and getting organized, and then making each day count.
Yeah, well, I think that's important. Monday's a very important day of the week. But I'm reflecting on what you just said. I remember when I had turned 40, I had a bit of an epiphany. I remember thinking it's either fit or fat at this point.
Yeah,
and I wanted to make sure it was the former, not the latter.
Yeah.
Something about that age.
Yeah.
And I think energy is so important in business. And keeping fit is actually necessary if you're going to have good energy 100%. In a workplace.
It makes a huge difference.
It does.
Yeah.
And then my last question, and it's in my interview book, Why You, 101 Questions You'll Never Fear Again, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Yeah, sure. So obviously we talked about where I kind of want to build Sprive, and I think the opportunity is endless. And so for that, you know, hopefully we can make Sprive and really help, you know, a lot of people, because I feel like if you think about fintech and financial services, I think the whole kind of industry is trying to get people into debt. They make money, you know, a lot of them make money from making that happen. And I think there needs to be someone that's trying to get people out of debt. And, you know, we're doing that. And so that's something that obviously I want to kind of continue to build out. Beyond that, it's interesting. I've always wanted to do more charity work. I feel like, again, I want to kind of take a step back and make a difference. And I feel like through charity, but real charity, not just donations, but actually if I can change someone's life, just even if it's one person's life for the better, and look, I haven't adopted, but like, you know, something really like meaningful, where a little bit like my grandfather, where he made a decision, his whole life was like transformed. If I could do that for someone, at least one person, I think that would be absolutely incredible. And so I'd love to do stuff like that, for sure. And then, who knows? But I want to be able to like make an impact.
I love what you just said about getting people out of debt.
Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant and inspiring objective. And if you do that for lots of people, believe me, you'll be helping a lot of people through your business.
No, through the business.
And then through your other activities. And then through,
but that's what I want to look back. Hopefully, I have a good long life, and I look back and be like, you know, me being born on this planet mean that, you know, people were better off, and that to me is more important than actual money and wealth.
Well, hear, hear to that. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to me, Janesh. I so enjoyed our conversation and feel thoroughly inspired. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, James.
Thanks, a real pleasure. Thank you, Janesh, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to learn more about Reed, Janesh Vohra, or Sprive, you'll find all the links in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.